Thor, Norse god of thunder. A fearless warrior who protects his people from monstrous giants. He was the idol of Vikings and barbarians in the darkest age ever known to man.
You better believe it. He did it, and this is his day, Thor's day, here in the bunker in north central Indiana, where we have all kinds of pagan gods running around. Ha, ha, ha. Hey, this is the 6th of August, dedicated to Augustus Caesar. August, yeah. The 6th day, and it's Thor's day. And here we go. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Now, we're receiving quite a number of your donations. That's good. Keep them coming. Now, I must say that there is one associate here, or one member of the group, the radio group, that's financing almost all the money orders to the prisoners. Now, we've got about a half a dozen. We send out $25 a month. And it's interesting that one person, or two people, are financing that whole operation. So you might want to think about that next time you send your donations in, adding a few more bucks for the POWs. These are guys who have paid the price and deserve it. These are not bad or lazy or run-of-the-mill inmates. These are white Aryan resistance, white soldiers that have paid the price. So think about that next time you send your 20 bucks in. But in the meantime, we'll do with what we have and get them out there for the guys. Don't miss these Morton Downey Jr. shows done at the Apollo Theater in Nigger Harlem, where we were challenged that we would never have the guts or the balls to appear at the Apollo Theater in the heart of Harlem. And we told them, oh yeah, you give us the plane tickets and we'll be there. And we were. And some of my great friends and my son and everybody were on that show. The best shows, I think, we ever did. And one thing I was glad to see, that they have the show with the Bone Crusher on, Carl Strait, one of my best men for many years. But if you haven't watched any shows, you need to watch these Morton Downey Jr. shows. They're going to be on regular television coming up later in the month, too. So you can tell people to look out for it. I mean, there were no punches pulled on these shows. If you ever wanted to see the difference between Tom Metzger and the general right wing and people like David Duke, watch these shows and you'll see. And don't forget, one of these shows is the one where Wyatt Kaldenberg, one of our main men at the time, broke Geraldo's nose. They tried to pass it off as a chair that was thrown. Yeah, there was a chair thrown, but that's not what broke his nose. It was Wyatt Kaldenberg got on top of him, and he was beating the shit out of him. And he complained about, when he got back to California, he complained that Geraldo, all he could do was scratch him. He was all scratched up. And don't forget, this show took place at the Apollo Theater, and I think the only other white man that ever stood on that stage was Buddy Holly. But anyhow, right in the middle of Harlem, and that theater was totally packed with Harlemite Negroes. I think we were the only white people there. Very, very few white people in that audience. I remember at one point there was a black kid up in the balcony, had his legs wrapped around a pole, leaning down off the balcony with a switchblade, twirling it around like, come on up here, come on up here. Yeah, man, those were the days.
So, as you know, we've just discovered that there are aliens because of that spaceship with aliens in that crashed, and they've got super advanced technology, and it's all massively frightening.
So, what's the plan?
Well, keep it all a complete secret from everybody, if at all possible.
Yes, of course. Although, why?
Well, if everybody knew that there were aliens, they might try and help us research or defend against them.
Why don't we want that?
Just general sort of... Well, it's nice to have secrets, isn't it?
Plus, the government is very keen that nobody should blame them for their being aliens.
Do that?
Well, they will when the aliens invade and they find out that we've known all along and could have been enlisting support all over the world in an effort to defend against them. There'll be hell to pay then. So.
Yeah, cross that bridge when we come to it. In the meantime, let's keep the existence of aliens, which is in no way our fault or, at this point, exclusively our problem, a complete secret.
How?
Well, we did catch a break there, actually. Fortunately, the aliens landed somewhere very remote, which is also a well-known top-secret army base.
Thank God for that. So we can hide away the dead aliens in that facility. We can also do an autopsy on them there and not tell anyone the results.
Yes, and just to make sure that nobody ever finds out, we should film it.
Agreed.
Is there any other way that people can find out? I mean, between now and the alien invasion, for which we'll leave the world unprepared?
Well, they do keep abducting people for weird sex.
Oh, dear. Well, the compelling nature of the evidence those people are going to come back to Earth with is something we can do nothing about.
Yes, well, we'll just have to pray that by good fortune there continue to be no independent witnesses.
Mm. The other problem is that quite a few excellent black and white photographers have pictures of what can pretty much only be spaceships.
I hate to be a skeptic, but why are we doing any of this?
Well, it doesn't really make sense, does it? But it's just the sort of thing that generally governments do. So, we're all agreed that that's the best way to do it.
Absolutely. It's so simple. No messing around with poison-tipped umbrellas or snipers. We just get a chauffeur drunk.
Slightly drunk.
And assume that he'll crash the car.
Yeah. As long as we pay for a bunch of motorcycling photographers to harass him, I'm sure that'll happen.
And the good news is that that only involves swearing another 15 or so people to perpetual silence.
Yes. Plus, people always die in car crashes, don't they?
Yes, always. And people who drive over the limit always crash. What we're organising here, my friends, is a watertight hit. My only worry is that it'll look so much like a murder that people will suspect.
Well, that is the risk we run by doing it this way. It will be totally obvious that it's an assassination. But remember what the Duke of Edinburgh said when he came in here to MI6 to give us our orders. I don't mind carrying the lifelong suspicion of murder on my shoulders as long as you kill her in such a way that absolutely nothing can go wrong.
Induced tipsy car crash it'll have to be then. It simply can't fail. Unless she wears a seatbelt.
No. She won't. She's unprovably pregnant, remember? Women recently impregnated by the only man they've ever loved are notoriously slapdash about their personal safety.
So, Dart, you're our best troubleshooter. Is there anything that we've missed?
I've just got one little niggle. Why are we doing this?
Well, because Prince Philip told us to. It's well known that the nation's security services are still pretty much at the beck and call of the royal family. This is top priority. The IRA can do whatever they like this weekend, let me tell you.
And why is he doing it?
Well, because she's so popular. She's beautiful and everyone loves her. We need to kill her now so that people will go off her.
Of course.
I mean, just think about it. If she's left alive to age as gracefully as one can while bringing up the bastard grandchild of a delusional Egyptian businessman, the public's just going to love her more and more.
You're quite right. As her appearance wrinkles and sags and she occasionally makes a vacuous remark about something complicated, people's hatred for the rest of the royal family will only intensify.
Whereas, if she's dead, she'll be forgotten in a week.
Yes, of course. You've made me feel very naive.
Hello? Oh. Life imitating art, I suppose. Right. Well, thank you. Well, you can stand down, everyone. That all just happened by accident.
Well,
boys and girls, we can't be totally serious all the time. Sometimes we have to have some facts to present you. So now that we've given you some facts on aliens and the death of the princess over in England, well, we can get on with the show. So let's get something serious on here, like Jesus never existed, which I can guarantee you is true.
in a previously unheard-of character is introduced. He plays a brief but vital role. He moves the body of Jesus from his cross to the tomb from which he will disappear. Without this crucial act, there would be no empty tomb. And without an empty tomb, claims of a resurrection, whilst not impossible, become considerably more problematic. What, for example, would become of the body if it was still rotting on the cross? Would it simply vanish while no one was looking? In any event, this new character does move the body, and with his job done, he is never heard of again. We are speaking of Joseph of Arimathea. Later Gospels will refine his character and modify his status, but in Mark's original tale, he is no more than a respected member of the Jewish council. The man from Arimathea is credited with single-handedly retrieving the body, wrapping it in a burial cloth, and placing the cadaver in a tomb, which he seals shut. Joseph, thereafter, disappears from the Christian story. The role is memorable for sure, but is this history or palpable literary artifice? It is 3 p.m., the ninth hour. The disciples have fled, the women watch meekly from afar, and a dead Jesus hangs on his cross. How does Mark bring his epic melodrama to a close? Nothing happens until evening has come, which for Jerusalem at the time of the Passover was around 5:30, 6 o'clock. Only now does Joseph, a member of the Jewish council, find the courage to approach the Roman governor. In so doing, in entering the praetorium, replete with its pagan imagery, he will make himself ritually impure, and it is only moments before the Sabbath begins. So why does a respected counsellor take such reckless action? Earlier in the story, we have been told that the condemnation of Jesus by the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, has been unanimous, and Mark emphasises that all the counsellors were involved. How is it possible, then, that Mark would now write that a member of the same council retrieved and disposed of the body of Jesus? At a minimum, the counsellor would become unclean for 7 days and would be unable to eat the sacred meal. Well, let's consider what were Mark's alternatives. The author had already determined that the followers of Jesus had all deserted him and fled. The fatherless family of Jesus had long since been put aside. As drama, the betrayal, denial, and abandonment of the Saviour intensified both the pathos of his death and the glory of the eventual confession that he was the risen Lord. But with the removal of all the other players, Mark had to create a new character to bring his drama to its grand finale. It also made sense for Mark to invoke a high-status individual for this role. Anyone less would not credibly have gained an audience with the Roman prefect, and an urgent audience at that. The respect that Mark says Joseph enjoyed implied that he was both of orthodox behaviour and strictly observed the law, both Jewish and Roman. In the inspirational work that Mark was working from, the book of Isaiah, the final indignity to be endured by the suffering servant was an ignominious burial. They will kill him and they will place him in the grave, implicitly a common grave reserved for criminals. In Mark's own first draft, or perhaps an earlier passion story that Mark was working from, the Son of Man was hung from a tree, and certainly not a crucifix, and his body was disposed of by his enemies, precisely as Isaiah foretold. Moreover, if such a figure as Joseph the counsellor came forward asking to bury the victim, a justification was to hand in Jewish scripture. Deuteronomy stipulated that a condemned man should not be left hanging on a tree overnight. But there was a problem. If Joseph stepped up Out of religious duty, his concern for the body of Jesus would surely have to extend to the bodies of the other two criminals, the transgressors. Either Mark himself, or more probably a later redactor, sidled in the meaningless qualifying phrase that Joseph was himself looking for the kingdom of God. It was a fudge, intended to give the impression that Joseph was especially in sympathy with Jesus, but avoiding the absurdity of saying that a disciple with a place on the council voted for the death of Jesus. Ironically, for all the multiple redactions and harmonizations, the residue of the idea that Jesus was not buried by a fortuitously well-placed devotee with a conveniently well-placed tomb is still to be found in the Acts of the Apostles. The words put into the mouth of the Apostle Paul by the author of Acts clearly attribute the burial of Jesus to his enemies, the residents of Jerusalem and their leaders, and not to any Joseph of Arimathea. A shameful disposal, though replaced in the canonical Gospels with an honourable burial, is found elsewhere, as for example in the 2nd century secret book of James, which again relates a dishonourable burial for Jesus. And that text even has Jesus himself say, "Buried shamefully, as was I myself by the evil one." The early 2nd century Gospel of Peter introduced Joseph not as a man of Arimathea, but as a friend of Pilate and of the Lord, an odd band of buddies for sure. It seems that this Joseph does indeed ask for the body, but he does so before the crucifixion and not after. But at the same time, Herod assured Pilate that in any event the Jews would have buried Jesus in observance of their own laws. The Jewish prince gave Jesus over to the people, and it was the Jews, not Roman soldiers, who clothed Jesus in purple, mocked his kingship, and put a thorny crown on his head. Some even scourged him. The Jews crucified Jesus and then rejoiced. The body was handed to Joseph for burial, but remarkably, it was a whole crowd of Roman soldiers, elders, and scribes who rolled the stone. In all this, we see how, at this point in time, an alternative version of the Passion narrative was in circulation, with elements of the tale rearranged. Could either version actually be true? If in reality there had been a Jesus who had been given a honourable burial by Joseph, how could any Christian writer have invented an alternative dishonourable burial? On the other hand, an evolving fiction, discarding a dishonourable burial in favour of something more respectful, would be a rational development of the text as the persona of Jesus became increasingly regal and deified. But let's just note, before leaving Mark's setup for the empty tomb climax to his story, the most obvious telltale sign that it is all a complete fiction. The supposed town of Arimathea is unknown to history, to archaeology, or even to the Old Testament. It is to be found only within the pages of the Gospels. Scholars have noted that the name itself may well have been fabricated from combining a Greek prefix, suffix, and root word, and actually mean best doctrine town. As if that wasn't damning enough, how could such a character as Joseph of Arimathea disappear so completely from subsequent Christian history? Only because he never existed in the first place.
And the one statement that caps it is when the Bible says, if Jesus did not rise from the grave and become alive, then your faith is in vain. So I'm telling you, there's a hell of a lot of Christians in this world that's faith is in vain. And if you say, well, yeah, but he was God, well, let's talk about Lazarus, and there was other people, not only in the Old Testament, but the New Testament. Lazarus rose from the grave. He had maggots all over his body. It was rotten, and he got up and walked around, went down to the bar and had a drink. Just remember that most of the people that are your leaders at least say they believe all this nonsense, and they have the power over you. Jesus. Well, let's get on with it. I'm going to put off the White Knight story till the first of the week to get back into that. But I leaned over and picked up another little book out of my big old library here, and I think you'll find it interesting. It's a little paperback book that it's called The Jew Comes to America. And I doubt whether any of you people have ever seen it. An expose of his career is profusely illustrated, too, with a lot of pictures of Jews that look like the ones that A. Wyatt Mann put together. Now, this originally was dug up and reprinted by, guess who? J.B. Stoner and Edward Fields, when they had the Thunderbolt. And they must have put out several thousand of these. But I venture to say, probably nobody in this club ever saw this book. And for those right-wing detractors of old Terrible Tommy that say he's gone soft on the Jews, come on, baby. Let's get into this book. The Jew Comes to America, this is the introduction, is a microscopic examination of the character of the wandering Jew. This is the study of a race which first flooded onto our shores in mass during the latter part of the 1800s. I do disagree a little bit about the racial aspects of Jews. They would love to be a race, and they certainly are ethnic people that are involved in just about every race around. That's their thing, is to infiltrate races and mislead the races. But anyhow, I'll go on with this. It was first the three great waves of immigrant Jews to arrive here from the area of Poland and Russia, where the majority of world Jewry then resided. The last great wave came fleeing the German occupation of Europe. Few people realize that the Jews have been expelled from 27 countries up through 1945. History has proven that it was their own obstructive behavior within these nations causing internal problems of such magnitude that expulsion resulted. Now, America has become the home of the world's largest concentration of Jewry. We are today experiencing the same problems that other nations of the past faced. Benjamin Franklin, one of the founders of our country, urged the Continental Congress to ban Jewish immigration from our shores. In his speech, Franklin pleaded, quote, "In whatever country Jews have settled in any great numbers, they have lowered its moral tone, depreciated its commercial integrity, have segregated themselves and have not been assimilated, have sneered at and tried to undermine the white race, have built up a state within a state, and when opposed have tried to strangle that country to death financially. If you do not exclude them from the United States in this Constitution, in less than 200 years, they will have swarmed in here in such great numbers that they will dominate and devour the land and change our form of government." I think they were right on time with that. "If you do not exclude them in less than 200 years, our descendants will be working in the fields to supply them substance or money, while they will be in the counting houses rubbing their hands gleefully. I warn you, gentlemen, if you do not exclude the Jews for all time, your children's children will curse you in your graves. Jews, gentlemen, are Asiatics. They will never be otherwise." It's interesting that there was a big fight about this, whether this was ever said by Ben Franklin, back in, I think it was the 60s or the 70s. Big fight over that. And it turns out that where that museum, I think it was up in northeast someplace, where that supposed document was at, people went there and suddenly it wasn't there anymore. And there were people who had witnessed that it really existed. So the nonsense that says, oh, no, he never said that, is totally untrue and a Jewish fabrication. This book details the beginnings of the Jew infestation of the American economic life, which now has grown to fulfillment of Franklin's prophecies. It describes the takeover of Wall Street, their corruptive influence upon politics and journalism, also the peculiar illegal lines which they are favorites of the Jews, are herein brought to light. Their inbred anti-white training, customs, and habits are also revealed. The most amazing part of this book is the fact that it is written by an anonymous author just before the turn of the century. Yet on every page we see before us the activities of the Jews in identical retrospect to what is now occurring in our midst. Quote, "The Jew Comes to America is a book containing rare insights into the nature of the Jew. It is a sensational eye-opener and can have profound effects upon America. It deserves your close study and result in action. Distribution of extra copies will help awaken new people to the seriousness of the Jewish problem. Knowledge of these truths will enable our suffering people to act in self-defense against the same malady which has plagued so many other nations and races of the past." This book probably should be reprinted again. I don't think it's available anymore. You might check with Dr. Fields down there in Georgia. Chapter 1. The Jew is the stain in the picture of civilization, the bad genius of the earth. That was a quote from Gustave Tridon. Toward the close of the year 1825, a band of Polish Jews, about 100 in number, landed in New York. Previously, there were hardly any Jews in this country. This band was under the leadership of one Guggenheim, and as they traveled through Europe to the land of their destination, they reminded one of those patriarchal families so often mentioned in the Old Testament. They were bound together not only by the ties of common religion, but by those of common misfortune, for they had suffered persecution at the hands of the Russians, which persecutions, however, they fully merited. These Jews, when first seen by the people of this country, presented a type different from any of the other immigrants that ever have landed upon our hospitable shores. They attracted unusual attention by their hooked noses, restless eyes, elongated ears, square nails, flat feet, round knees, and soft hands. Myriads of parasites could be seen by the naked eye, wrestling upon their dirty heads. They wore long coats dripping with filth, while their faces and beards looked suety and sluttishness. The above description of this batch of Jew immigrants is not in the least exaggerated. Not one among them had with him any other wearing apparel than the scanty garments he wore. When they landed, they had no friends to welcome them, they had no resources, they were ignorant of the language of the country, and it was doubtful whether one amongst them had sufficient money to pay for a night's rest in the cheapest Bowery lodging house of today. But within a few years after their arrival, we find the greater part of these Jews occupying prominent positions in the financial world of the metropolis. Later on, we find their descendants prominent as bankers in New York, prominent as bankers in Chicago, in St. Louis, and in other leading cities in the United States. It is the descendants of the above-described Jew immigrants who today display with vulgar effrontery their wealth, who control the clothing business, the tobacco business, the sugar business of this great country, and who establish newspapers that cast a stigma upon American journalism, and who seek to direct and mold public opinion. How have these Jews accomplished all of this? It is by their surprising intelligence. No, there is no race of men more intelligent than the Aryan. Is it by any useful invention on their part, or by devoting themselves to mechanical pursuits? No, certainly not. Again, the most diligent inquiry fails to discover any considerable number of Jew farmers throughout the territory of the United States. One will look along before he finds a Jew laborer among the workmen who build our railroads, work our mines, or develop the resources of this country. The Jew's soft hands and curved fingers grasp only the values that others have produced. Wherever the Jew is allowed to establish himself, dishonesty takes the place of honesty, immorality of virtue, disease of health, sluttishness of cleanliness, anarchy of order. One has but to study the social and political history of different nations in Europe during the last 50 years to discover the poisonous work of the Jew. He has sapped the foundations of every government. He has reduced France from a nation of first rank to a second-class power. He has made Russia to writhe under the incessant internal revolutions. He has ruined Turkey. He has so thoroughly impregnated England with his own Jewish cowardice that England's martial spirit has sadly deteriorated. He is now carrying out his work of deterioration and destruction in the United States. From the time when the Jew first appeared upon the face of the earth, to this day, history does not record a single invention that can be claimed by the Jews. They have never founded a state of any magnitude, though they have always been more numerous than the Romans, who conquered the world, and now exceed in numbers any of the minor peoples of Europe. With a momentary exception in Moorish Spain, they have never dominated any people or consolidated any people, even in the East, where they have had their chances, or founded any great city. They have never produced a great soldier, and we cannot yet credit them with a statesman of first class. Lord Beaconsfield was hardly more than a great party leader in politics, though he had a certain genius for apprehending the passing waves of emotion of the British people. Herr Lasker has never overthrown a government. M. Fowde has only a clear-headed banker, and Sir H. Drummond Wolfe has scarcely made a mark. The peculiar way the Jew has of accomplishing his diabolical work, or of getting along, to use his own expression, can be best illustrated by studying the early history of the little hand of Jew immigrants above referred to. They began life in the New World as itinerant vendors of cheap notions, for their petty stock in trade consisted of pencils, pens, stockings, pocketbooks, and all manner of odds and ends they were trusted. But every night they were obliged to make returns of sales made to the one who had supplied them with the goods. Gradually they increased their little capital, and next they became receivers of stolen goods. And to this day it is the Jews who control this peculiar industry in all our cities. They established pawn shops, made advances for which an exorbitant rate of interest was charged, exercised every manner of usury, and introduced crookedness and theft in all transactions. They established petty stores, stocked them with an insignificant amount of cheap goods, insured them far beyond their actual value, and shortly afterwards set fire to them, collecting the insurance, and repeating this crime from time to time throughout history. Thus they grew rich. This crime of incendiarism, previously to the advent of the Jews, was with us, comparatively speaking, unknown. The Jews mulcted the insurance companies of vast sums of money before the companies became aware of the fraud practiced upon them. It is a matter of record that many of the leading insurance companies today hesitate and often refuse to insure the stock of anyone having a Jewish countenance or a Jewish name. Recently, the president of a large insurance company telegraphed to his agent in Chicago, quote, "Look carefully before taking any risk offered by men whose names end in Ein, Ki, or K-I-E. Good advice indeed. It has been said that the Jews despise manual labor. Whoever heard of a Jew miner? Still, no sooner is the mining camp established than it is followed by the Jew vampires, who rob the sturdy miner of his hard-earned wages by every kind of deceit. The Irishman, the German, the Italian, in a word, the immigrant from every part of the world has contributed, and still contributes, more or less to the prosperity of our country. The Jew, we repeat it, has never done anything tending to increase the national prosperity. He only seeks the fat of the land. He only thrives upon what others produce. We have been accused of being Jew-baiters, of wishing to create a revolution against the Jews. This is not true. We despise only villainy, and our aim is to direct the attention of the Americans to the danger that lurks in the Jew. What is worshipped in the ghetto is not the God of Moses, it is the frightful Semitic Moloch, who claims as victims children and virgins from the original Mr. Jacobs. Jew York, like Rome, has its ghetto, or low Jewish quarter, and it is safe to most emphatically to declare that in physical degradation, squalor, misery, and dirt, the New York ghetto is unsurpassed by that of the Eternal City or of any great metropolis on the face of the earth. The New York ghetto, and that is the name by which it is duly styled by the officials of the Board of Health and of police headquarters, is situated in those narrow thoroughfares on the east side lying between the Grand and the Catherine and Ludlow and Division Streets. The houses in the ghetto are all tall, narrow, noisome tenements, packed from the basement to the roof with swarming, unwashed humanity. The locality is practically given over exclusively to the descendants of Israel, the disgruntled habits and the extreme filth of the latter being such as to drive away from immediate vicinage even the most miserable and lowest representatives of other races. Enter one of these frightful tenements given over to the sons and daughters of Israel, and the nostrils are instantly assailed on the very threshold by fearful stenches, which can best be compared to the odor arising from vegetables in a highly advanced state of decomposition. Pass a little farther along the hallway, and the malodorous atmosphere becomes so thick with putrescent exhalations as to suggest the idea that you could cut it with a knife. The walls are disfigured with great streaks and blotches of foul moisture and dirt. And vermin, those faithful little companions of the Jews, even to the wealthiest, are to be detected at not infrequent intervals. Turn into the apartments branching off from these ghastly hallways, and you will find them ill-ventilated, pestilential, and filthy in the extreme. So overcrowded are they as to suggest the worst portions of the Chinese colony in San Francisco. In many instances, a father, mother, grown-up daughter and son, and several little olive branches of the Israel, big-bellied, big-nosed, and in more or less advanced stages of development in dirt, are to be found occupying the same sleeping apartment. Only a Jew could live in such an atmosphere of moral and physical debasement and survive. And yet poverty cannot be ascribed as the cause of the Jew of the ghetto living in this way. He lives, yes, and thrives in this wretchedness and filth, partly because filth is congenial to him, and partly from the desire to more rapidly save and accumulate the only thing in this world he cares for, dollars and cents. You know, this reminds me of the story of Dracula. And the legend is that Dracula cannot go to another country without going in a coffin filled with the dirt and so forth of his own country, where he comes from, which fits right in with these Jews bringing the filth and the most rotten living conditions with them from Europe. Many of these Jews of the ghetto are far better off than Gentiles living in neat and well-appointed flats on the west side. Some of them are, in fact, quite well-to-do. Later on, perhaps, they will branch out as merchants in leading thoroughfares with social ambitions and the regulation amount of Jewish ostentation, impudence, and arrogance. Their sons will figure at the Delmonico's and at the swell summer resorts and clamor for admission at the fashionable clubs, but launch out of as they may, array themselves in broadcloth and fine linen as they will, the stink of the ghetto and mayhap some of its vermin will cling to them still. No matter how wretched or how low he may be, the Jew rarely becomes a workman, a creator, speaking in a political economic sense of wealth. On the contrary, he almost invariably figures as a dealer, a jobber, a trader. Thus, none of the Jews of the ghetto are laborers or artisans, but are to the unit street salesmen, peddlers, petty traders. One of the chief forms of avocation in the ghetto is peddling of fish, fruit, poultry, and meat. And what fish and fruit, what meat? In his greed to acquire gain, the Jew does not hesitate at poisoning an entire community. The fish he sells is decayed, the fruit rotten, the meat putrid. Thousands of human beings are sickened and sent down to their graves every year in New York City by the fruit and the fish, the poultry and the meat peddled by the Jew of the ghetto. And how does it happen that the food peddled by these miserable wretches is in the shocking condition? Happen? It's not a question of happening. It is a matter of design, for the Jew drags the four corners of the city to secure his putrid food. He haunts the markets of the city, buying up food which has become stale on the dealer's hands and is either on the point of becoming decayed or has already passed into a state of putrescence. He hangs it around the docks at which vessels have arrived and buys up remnants of stores which remain unconsumed after the voyage. The more rotten the food, the better it pleases the Jew, for it is so much cheaper. Having thus collected this filthy food, the Jew takes it to his dirty quarters in the ghetto, where it is pawned over by the unwashed fingers of other members of the household, and after it costs has been duly quibbled over and discussed, it is fixed up in the best shape possible for sale. The Jew of the ghetto has, of course, no storing place, and consequently the food is kept in overcrowded dwelling apartments until such time as it can be hawked in the streets. Imagine a couple of filthy rooms occupied by two, perhaps four, unwashed adults and half a dozen dirt-bedaubed brats, the ceiling damp with slimy moisture, cockroaches and vermin crawling over the furniture, the great lines of decaying fruit or fish or meat strung across from wall to wall. Imagine such a scene, and you have a picture of the Jew tenement in the ghetto. The day after making his purchase of the refuse of the markets, Jew sallies forth with his hand truck or cart to sell his unwholesome supply. He is usually accompanied by his wife or by one of the elder olive branches of Israel. He stations himself on some street corner in a poor but populous thoroughfare, and by his cheap prices tempts the unwary to buy. He sells his wares laden down as they are with the germs of disease, alike to the unsophisticated housewife and to the innocent child, without one touch of pity, without one sting of remorse. He, as a grinning skeleton, a figure of evil, standing by the wayside and scattering the fetid germs of disease and death among the wayfarers, young and old, as they pass him by. But sometimes retribution, sharp, sudden, and swift, sweeps down upon him in the form of avenging angels of the Board of Hell. This is one reason why there are elements in this country, and not just the Jews now, that want to weaken the health laws and the food and drug laws and like that, and how they stack these different agencies in Washington with people from the very corporations that are causing the problem. They want to weaken any kind of law like that because they can make more money. And of course, millions of white Aryans have caught the Jew disease themselves through Christianity and so forth. At repeated intervals, especially in the summertime, the officials of the health department make wholesale and systematic raids upon the peddlers from the ghetto in the interest of public safety. However, many times these people are bribed to look the other way. Then upon such occasions ensued scenes of indescribable confusion and of dire weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth in Israel. The fat and paunchy Jewess will tear their hair and call upon God of Jacob and Aaron to witness how sweet and pure is the food they sell and how they are persecuted. They make the most wild and frantic efforts to save even the smallest portion of their disgusting wares, often sticking huge hunks of rotten fish or decaying meat under their petticoats in the hope of saving them from seizure by the Board of Health. But the Board of Health officials are lynx-eyed and inexorable. They ruthlessly seize the vile food, confiscate it, hurling it pell-mell into the carts brought along with them for the purpose, carrying it off for destruction. During the past year, 74,000 pounds of unwholesome fish were seized upon in the ghetto by the Board of Health, and upwards of 150,000 pounds of putrid meat, poultry, and fruit from the same quarter met with a similar fate. But the Jew of the ghetto is incorrigible. He repairs his filthy tenement, weeps the bitter tears and avarice over his loss, and then returns to his trade of wholesale poisoner. Very similar, his modes of living to the Jew of the ghetto is the Jew of Baxter Street, New York, the famous old Clo Jew, who has been held up as a butt of ridicule by novelists and playwrights and newspaper writers from time immemorial. In Baxter Street, for a couple of blocks south of Pearl Street, the thoroughfare on both sides of the street is lined with an unbroken string of these old Clo shops. Old trousers, old coats, and old garments of every description hung from the walls of the houses and flaunt in the breeze to the height of two stories. Outside the doors of the dingy, ill-smelling shops lounge men of black, beady eyes, swarthy skins, and the great hawk-like nose of Israel and the fat Jewesses, heavy of jowl and of paunch, who brazenly solicit passers-by to buy their wares. Whenever a stranger enters the street, he is at once assailed by a running fire of solicitation that fairly overwhelms him. Don, you want to buy a fine hair of Bans Meester? I sell you nice waistcoat of Tiki Porter. Come, look at this suit of clothes I have me here for $4.50. It will fit you like der paper on der wall, unquote. These and thousands of other similar exclamations greet the passerby and his avidity to close their long claw-like fingers upon his money. These rival dealers of old clothes actually lay violent hands upon the wayfarer and seek to drag him by main force into their shops. Reminds me of what I ran into within the walls of Jerusalem. This stuff is still going on. And same thing happens if you go down to Tijuana or any place like that. If he show the least inclination to trade, he is in danger of being literally torn apart by the rival dealers. Enter one of the shops, and a fat Jewess will likely unhesitatingly and unblushingly measure the customer for a pair of trousers or assist him in trying on a new vest or other garment. The Jew, in his eagerness to sell, does not hesitate to heap ridicule even upon himself. Quote, I was an honest sheeny man. I give you cent per cent value for your money, is an expression frequently to be heard. An honest sheeny. And that word was used a lot. I remember when I was a kid, my father used to use that word quite a bit to describe Jews. And at one time he worked in a factory that made desks for schools, which was in North Manchester, Indiana. And it was owned by a Jew. and I never heard my father ever call him by any other name than the Jew. When I worked for the Jew, that was his only name that I ever heard in our house, the Jew. But if you know how to go about it. Now, he never said bad things that I can recall about this Jew that was his employer, but he described him always as the Jew. But if you know how to go about it, you can buy something besides old clothes in Baxter Street. Gold watches, enameled lockets, costly overcoats, sealskin sacks, and even diamonds may be bought in these same dirty little shops, if you are not too particular about inquiring the history of these objects of value and whence they came. For the old clothes dealer is almost to a man what is technically known in police circles as a fence, and in cellars and hiding places of the old clothes dealer's shop, stolen goods are stored away in quantities. Quote, I have a rich uncle who was in der bond provoking business. I got from him. I sell it to you cheap, and don't say word about it, says Fagin, in disposing of some ill-gotten article of value. But the Jew of Baxter Street is probably the least dangerous and objectionable of his race. He is, it is most conceded, in his rightful sphere. Would that all the members of his race could be restricted to their natural element, the old clothes business. The general detestation and abhorrence and contempt with which American Jew is regarded socially is, perhaps, nowhere more strongly exemplified than at the summer resort hotel. Now, you see how far it's changed the other way? Now, they're the top of the mark, man. The Kardashians and all these kind of people, and gotten into high society and the best clubs and everything else. And don't kid yourself, Donald Trump rubs shoulders with those people and does a lot of business with them. So don't go running off becoming a Trumpite. It's all a game. Nearly every hotel keeper at the summer resorts throughout the country is anxious to exclude the Jew from his house, and keeps a sharp and constant watch to bear him out. You know how they're played, I forget that one movie with Gregory Peck, I think it was, where the guy tries to rent a room in a hotel, and they said, well, I'm sorry, you're Jewish, no Jews allowed, and they make the guy, the Jew, look like an Aryan, usually. And also, it's this horrible, poor Jew. Jews are wonderful, they never did anything wrong, and they're being told they can't have a room in a hotel. But we know how it really goes. They don't want the Jews in their hotels because of certain ways that they operate. Owing to the Jew's characteristic lack of delicacy, his obtrusiveness and impudence, this is a somewhat difficult matter. But the summer hotel keeper, who by dint of long practice and experience is enabled to smell a descendant of the tribe a long way off, succeeds fairly well, too. Whenever a Jew nose casts its sinister shadow over the register, the hotel keeper suddenly discovers that his hostelry is full to overflowing, and profoundly but firmly regrets his inability to receive any more guests. Whenever a Moses or a Jacobs or a Blumenstein writes asking for accommodations, a reply is hastily rushed off to him, to the effect that every room in the house has been engaged 3 months ahead. Often the Jew, surmising how he is detested and abhorred, but determined to thrust his nose where it is not wanted, contrives in applying by letter to conceal his nefarious identity. In this way he at times succeeds in slipping in. Then the hotel keeper's silent wrath is terrible to witness. His days and nights are passed in fear and trembling of some infamous fox paw on the part of his unbidden guest, and he feels himself in constant danger of his white Aryan guests, sending down their bills and deserting the house and not coming back. Only too often in such cases are his worst fears realized. Well, they got around that with the anti-discrimination laws, right? The only way you can tell a free man from a slave is the ability to discriminate. That's the one main reason of saying you're free and not a slave. But you see, once they got the anti-discrimination laws in, then nobody could deny these people entrance to their hotels or anything else. And of course, that was the major, major weapon they're using against the white Aryan race. And we put up with it, or most of society puts up with it. And yet, heaven knows, and well, most of society sympathizes with these people. Say, oh, you won't let this dirty, swarthy nigger in your hotel? We're going to sue you for everything you've got, Mr. Hotel Man. And this creepy, mob-connected Jew, you're not going to leave this poor guy in your hotel or your club? Well, we'll take you to the federal office and get you for discrimination and take everything you've got. That's how far it's gone. It's gone so far that it's irretrievably lost, other than a major, physical, ruthless uprising of the Aryan people. And I support that. And yet, heaven knows, the summer hotel keeper is not one to be any too particular as to the character of his guests. What with the shortness of the season and the heavy expenses he's under, it is not so much quality as quantity of guests that he is after. But the Jew is so objectionable in general manners and habits and bearing, so obnoxious to good morals, good manners, and good taste, that he is sure to drive other guests away from the house. Now, have you ever been on a tour, like in a foreign country? Everybody I've talked to that has been on tours in a foreign country where Jews were involved as guests on the tour, they become obnoxious. Maybe not all of them, but one or two will become terribly obnoxious. I know my lady was on a tour, and they were over in Europe, and the tour they were on, there was a couple of Jews got on a bus or something, and they were absolutely obnoxious. And that's today. That's not 200 years ago or 150 years ago. I'm glad, at least when I went to Israel on the tour, I didn't detect any Jews on the tour, but the tour master, who tour guide, and he seemed to be a pretty tame Jew. Was not obnoxious. Hence, by reason of his general vileness, he is a source of pecuniary loss to the hotel keeper, and therefore the latter, liberal-minded or indifferent as he may be, keeps him out. One thing good about the olden days was it wasn't that hard to identify a Jew. They did have a lot of physical characteristics. And but even back then, I mean, you know, you had leaders in the British government and so forth, the Disraeli and people like that. But most of them were coming in from into Europe from Poland and the East, and they were Sephardics, dark and with all these funny characteristics. But as they assimilated as Ashkenazims in Germany, France, and other places, millions of them became lost many of their identifying characteristics, physical, and where you would not necessarily know it's a Jew. And it's even worse today. It's much, much worse today. I've heard these so-called National Socialists that think they know everything about Jews that say, well, I could detect a Jew blocks away. They'll never get by me. I can spot him. And they can have a Jew sitting right beside him. And that's how so many of these National Socialists and Klans people and all that get caught. They get caught in something. It's because they don't even recognize a Jew when the Jew is right next to them as an agent or business people or anything like that. So when you sit down at a restaurant and start talking to people or anything like that or any social situation, you have to be extremely careful today if you suspect someone of being Jewish and nefarious and you better be on the ball. I remember one television show where they were covering all the, and I've told this story before, but there's always new people. I'm going to tell it again, to where they were doing this documentary on the Nazis in Europe. And to infiltrate the Nazis, they brought in this Jew from Australia. And he set up an office and everything like that, and then contacted and joined up with the Nazis. And at one point in this documentary, the so-called top Nazi in Europe, and this was only a couple of decades ago, was sitting in this car in a seat next to this Jew, and he said to the Jew, "I can spot a Jew half mile away. They could never get by me." And he was sitting right next to a Jew. So all you smart-ass Hollywood Nazis that think you can identify the enemy so easily, you're going to get screwed. Hence, by reason of his general vileness, he is a source of pecuniary loss to the hotel keeper, and therefore the latter, liberal-minded or indifferent as he may be, keeps him out. But to come right down to details, what are the particularly objectionable qualities in the Jew guest? Well, they are almost too numerous to enumerate. The first place, the Jew is loud, vulgar, and intrusive, and I'm sure in this modern day you run into a lot of those people, and most of them are in the movies or in the comedians and on the stage. He is loud in his speech and in his dress. He is vulgar in his deportment in the hotel corridors and on verandas. His table manners are execrable. That's a tough word. I never heard it before. Not to say disgusting. And he is intrusive in forcing his company with a brazen impudence that knows no check upon people who do not desire to suffer the infliction and contamination of his acquaintances. I remember when I was in the military, I traveled by myself and I dressed like the natives, and I was in Amsterdam and I went to the art museum with all the master's paintings, and I remember running into Jews there who were dressed crazily, loudly, with shorts and cameras all over them, standing in front of the great master's paintings, loud and abrasive, and you could hear them all the way down the hall. As for the fat Jewesses, as they waddle across the hotel veranda, their gross paunches quivering and their coarse, pudgy fingers covered with diamonds, they are objects of offensive to the sight, blotches on the summer landscape, veritable eyesores. They're in their wake, are quite as objectionable as the men. You see, that's why I say not only the women, but the men, white Aryans of this country, are becoming that way. Mirror image of these slovenly, fat, paunchy, out-of-shape, loud-mouthed Jews. So we're even becoming physically like these Jews were in the old days. Think about that. Especially the women you see around in your town, in the grocery store, Walmart, and so forth. They're absolutely atrocious. And I don't leave the men off the hook either, but it's more the women than the men. Then, too, another reason why the Jew and the Jewesses are objectionable to the hotel keeper is that the Israelite is ever haunted with the feeling that he is not getting enough for his money. He's paying high terms. He feels that he never can eat up enough and use up enough to make an equivalent for the outlay he is undertaking. The thought that the hotel keeper may be making too much profit out of him causes cold shudders to run down his spine, no matter how high in the 90s the thermometer may stand. These curious feelings lead him into wasting food which he cannot eat, and subjecting the furniture and carpets to unnecessary rough usage, as if to thereby get more for his money. Singular, is it not? It is probably a symptom and an outcrop of that neurosis to which the Jews as a race are subject, and which was explained at length in the original Mr. Jacobs. Never, probably, were the reasons why the summer hotel keeper bars out the Jew from his house more energetically and more forcefully expressed than by certain wealthy and prominent citizen whose actions in publicity shutting the Jews out from his hotel at the most fashionable of all New York summering places, creating a tremendous sensation some years ago on the night following the day when the edict of exclusion was issued. This gentleman, upon being hard-pressed for his reasons, thus expressed himself to an interviewer of the New York Times, quote, "You presume that I had good reasons for shutting out the Jews from the Grand Union." Good reasons, eh? Well, I should say I had. After screwing and scraping and hoarding all winter, these Jews come to the Grand Union for a couple of weeks bent on cutting a shrine. Not content with obtruding their offensive personalities on the verandas of the hotel and monopolizing the chairs to the exclusion of white guests, they cock their great ungainly feet high in the air and talk shop in the voices to be heard a mile away. They come down to the dining room, gorge themselves into bursting, and fearing they will not get enough for their money, they go upstairs again and vomit over the furniture. Descending again to the dining room, they gorge themselves once more and then swagger out upon the veranda and protrude their ill-shaped bellies in Aryan faces. Rather would I shut up the hotel forever than again admit another Jew. And that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, Freya's Day. And this guy pretty well puts it on the line, doesn't he? And this is the way most Aryans felt about Jews 150 years ago, way back. But boy, I'll tell you today, they've got through the use of Christianity as a weapon and other means of crooked politicians, they've turned the tables completely around. 14:5.